I'm Stephen Metcalf, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest Bogus Journey Edition. It's Wednesday, September 2nd, 2020. On today's most excellent show, Bill and Ted Face the Music. It's the belated sequel to the wonderfully inane movies of the 80s and early 90s, starring Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter. They return as their most egregiously non-bogus middle-aged selves, Bill and Ted. And then Chadwick Boseman has died at the age of 43. We're joined by Wesley Morris of the New York Times to discuss the legacy of a great actor and movie star lost before his time. And finally, Dana had what appears to be maybe our final comfort pick, at least for now. She chose Days of Heaven, the Terrence Malick movie from the late 1970s. It stars Richard Gere, Sam Shepard, Brooke Adams, and Linda Mance, who herself has just passed away. We will discuss. Joining me today is Julia Turner, who's the deputy managing editor of the LA Times. Hey, Julia.
Hello, hello.
And of course, Dana Stevens, the film critic for Slate.com. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Steve.
Okay, before we dig in, Dana, we do have some good news.
Yes, we have some very good news for us, and I hope for our listeners too, which is that the Slate Culture Gabfest is going weekly again with the coming of fall and the crisping of the leaves and the somewhat adjusting of the economy to our new pandemic circumstances. We can now afford to make our show every week once more. So in the grand tradition of the Slate Culture Gabfest, you will be hearing from us every week going forward.
Yay! Thank you all so much for hanging in through our Fortnightitude.
And thanks, of course, to anyone who helped it happen by joining Slate Plus during this interregnum period of biweekliness.
But this is not an excuse to slack. Keep signing up for Slate Plus. We still need you.
We definitely do.
I got car payments. All right. Shall we dig in?
Let's.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure came out at the end of the 1980s, a decade not especially well known for its kindness. Played by Keanu Reeves and Alex Winter as overgrown human puppy dogs, Bill and Ted seem to promise that a fallen world might yet be saved by a pair of disarmingly naive kids from San Dimas, California. If only they could pass their history exam. That was the sort of tepid MacGuffin of the first one. To that end, they traveled through time in an enchanted phone booth, meeting Napoleon and, as they called them, Socrates and Freud, a.k.a. Socrates and Freud. The new movie returns the two actors. Bill and Ted are now middle-aged but still living as wannabes in a world that is still fallen. They may yet save it and their marriages, but first they must write a song so beautiful it brings about the promised utopia. Let's listen to a clip.
Okay, now all we got to do is write the greatest song ever written
that brings the entire world into rhythm and harmony,
and saves reality as we know it.
All through time. Dude, we've spent our whole life trying to write the song that will unite the world. What makes us think we can write it in like 75 minutes?
Ted, we had to have written that song. The people in the future told us we did.
Yeah, I guess.
Which means we have it in us, dude. Maybe we just haven't written it yet. Maybe we're still gonna.
Well, if we haven't written it yet, but we know we're gonna at some point, why can't we just go to the future when we have written it?
And take it from ourselves!
Yeah!
Ted! You have had many counterintuitive ideas over the years, but this is by far the counterintuitivest of them all, dude!
All right, I see our producer laughing in his Zoom window. Therefore, I am objectively correct in my opinion that the Bill and Ted universe is a boon for the world. But Julia is about to shower down her robot cruelty upon it.
Oh, my God. Well, listen, before we get there, I should say the film also stars Samara Weaving and Bridget Lundy Payne as the two daughters of the respective Bill and Ted. And they have to help their hapless fathers out by assembling the world's greatest band. Ends up featuring Louis Armstrong, Hendrix, and Mozart, and others. But Dana, Other than that, what is the very most, most excellent fact about this movie?
I don't know. I think you're going to have to tell me.
I'm going to give you a hint. It was directed by Dean Pariseau, who is also known for...
Galaxy Quest.
There we go.
Yes.
I knew that was going to come up.
The all-time most excellent, comfortingest movie ever made. But anyway, Dana, go ahead, defend this. Turns out you're a Bill and Ted completist. I did not... would not have guessed this about you.
Yes, well, I mean, part of why this new Bill and Ted chapter is dear to me is that it's sort of part of my rehabilitation into the Slate universe, because during this same interregnum time that we were going bi-weekly, I was also not writing film criticism for Slate for various reasons. I mean, because of budget cuts, because of my own book deadlines, because there aren't any movies opening in theaters. So this was my triumphant return, and I insisted on it. When I saw this movie was coming out way at the beginning of the year, before the pandemic was even a threat on the horizon, I said, I want that movie. Because, I mean, this is completely the movie of my demographic, right? I'm almost exactly the age of Keanu Reeves, maybe a couple years younger. And I sort of feel like, you know, everybody's in love with Keanu now, but I'm grandfathered in there because I fell in love with Keanu in real time, not even in this movie, but several years before, I think, in River's Edge, which was the first thing I had ever seen him in. And to some degree, I think it's Keanu that carries this, I will agree, very slight franchise. But Alex Winter is really excellent, too, and most excellent. And the chemistry between them, I think, is what makes these movies so fun. And it's been really great in the run-up to this movie, seeing all the coverage, like the joint interview that the two of them did with David Zkoff for The Times. And, you know, other places, I think they did a Variety podcast together. And they're friends in real life, like not just guys who are friendly on a movie set, but like they take vacations together. Their families know each other. And that really shows, I think, in these three movies, which really do show, you know, sort of a friendship growing through time. And ultimately, I think what I love about these movies is, as you said, Steve, just their innocence and naivete and kindness, and the fact that the catchphrase of Bill and Ted that, you know, saves reality as we know it is be excellent to each other and party on, dudes. But I will just say that to me, these three movies occupy a very specific and lovable niche.
I have waited so long to just sit back and watch Julia Turner crap all over something you said, Dana, all over your hopes and dreams. And I'm just going to do that right now, Julia.
First of all, I rewatched the original Bill and Ted, which I watched like probably in a theater when it came out. Or maybe on a VHS from Video to Go shortly thereafter, and loved. And that movie holds up. There are a couple out-of-step gay jokes and, you know, dated bits to it, but it is completely charming. So I still love the first one. I'm pro Bill and Ted in general. But this recent one, is terrible. It's a terrible movie. Like, it has some bits of charm in it. I really think the performances by the daughters are charming. The way that the plot unfolds to give the daughters interesting things to do feels decade appropriate. But the whole sequence where they are gathering musicians from throughout history to play this epic song is just dreadful. Like, the actor who plays Louis Armstrong is terrible. The kind of bone drummer is like racist and stupid. There's also no Latin in a movie that seems to be taking great pains to put together a diverse set of world music. There's no Latin music greats of any kind, which is sort of embarrassing and stupid. And then I also, and this is going to cut closer to the bone, I don't think Keanu is very good in this movie. Yeah. I think that Alex Winter plays like a really great aged version of Bill, but I think that Keanu's, I don't know, the way in which his like melancholy lockedness expresses itself through the like floppy dopiness of the character just seemed kind of, it just wasn't very fun. And I get that it's maybe not fun to have a midlife crisis, but I mean, Keanu is such a funny actor, such a great actor, and he just seemed, I don't know, stuck. It was not a super enjoyable performance.
It's a weird performance. I don't disagree. I will say I really liked the movie. I wondered at the bone drummer you know, that they retrieve from our earliest history or prehistory. I wondered whether that was racist. I mean, I understand that it was an attempt to not be racist, to say that the origin of all human civilization is from here, including obviously music, but they just handled it, I agree, very poorly. So bracketing that for one second, I did rewatch the first one with my kids. It was a sort of a double revelation. The first is that they just had no idea what fucking planet this movie had dropped from. I mean, the zeitgeist out of which it came, the kinds of performances, the silliness of it, the lightness of it, nothing like it exists in their universe. And I think that they were flummoxed by it completely. But the other revelation is in rewatching the movie is Reeves, who's so incredibly disarming as Ted. I mean, they're both wonderful, and it's a comedic, great comedic turn by very, at the time, probably green young actors. But there's something extra that Keanu brings to Ted, and it's both the puppyishness, like you can't stop sort of bouncing in the screen. He's just kind of bouncing, and there's this beamingness to him, and it's as if there's a bag full of puppies inside of him trying to get out of him. And it's infectious. I mean, and since the essence of the movie is, perhaps the worst quality of Americans is that we're historical amnesiacs and we have no appreciation for the fact that civilization preceded us. But perhaps our best quality is bound up in that, which is that out of that forgetfulness comes a very simple goodwill that might possibly redeem at least us, if not maybe others as well. I mean, one hopes. And so the whole movie lacked a sour note. It was not a very knowing, it's a completely unknowing movie in some ways. It wasn't very sharply written. It wasn't satirical. It was just weirdly excellent, right? It sort of embodied its own theory of excellence in its naivete and simplicity. And so my question approaching this new one was, could you sharpen it and bring it into the present without also bringing in the knowingness of comedic writing today, that kind of slightly shit-eating irony with which Bill and Ted wouldn't be Bill and Ted? And I actually thought they did a pretty good job. And I thought they kind of mined the middle-aged thing oddly well in a way. Weirdly, the whole thing kind of worked for me, though I have a lot to say about Keanu, but more of that later. What do you think?
Well, what you say about the writing doesn't really ring with me, because I think what makes this whole trilogy, in a way, is the writing. And the writing isn't just by the same guys, Ed Solomon and Chris Matheson, all through the series, right? This isn't a writer's room being brought in by some studio. This is two guys, right, who are also friends, you know, who are their own Bill and Ted in real life, aging along with their characters. And I think that that really is what holds the series together for me.
Mm-hmm.
Is that as Bill and Ted age, and we haven't talked about the middle movie, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, which I think may be my favorite of the three, where they go down to hell together and play Twister with death, among other things. But the second movie already starts to be a movie about how do you grow up, right? How do you leave behind the kid in the garage in San Dimas who wants to play with Eddie Van Halen but doesn't know how to play his guitar, right? And start to mature into someone who could have a marriage and children and all the things they acquire over the course of the movies. That seems quite sharp in the writing to me. I mean, really, this last movie is about underachievement, right? And what do you do, yes, when you're a 50-something underachiever? They can now play their instruments really well, but they still can't write this magical song. And there are some jokes at the end about whether, you know, the song that may or may not finally emerge to save the world is really going to be all that good. And I mean, maybe a part of me just identified, you know? I mean, I feel like I am Bill and Ted. I know what it is to be that person who's wondering, you know, is my moment ever going to come? Am I ever going to save the world? And that seems like where Generation X has been and always will be stuck. And maybe a part of me just felt a kind of melancholy allegiance with that. And I don't know, the special effects are endearingly bogus. There's just something about this universe that I love.
Okay, but can I tell you about something else that I find bogus?
Please.
There's so much female empowerment. They have these really cool daughters. The daughters are even more musically astute than Bill and Ted and much more Catholic in their tastes. And wow, they have such power. And, you know, they sort of make as a joke, the movie opens with this wedding where Missy, the kind of high school hottie who's a couple years out of high school, who in the first movie is Bill's stepmom, and then we later learn, in fact, also became Ted's stepmom and is now marrying Ted's brother, is played by the same actress who played her in the first film. You know, so we get to see this hottie of 31 years ago as like a middle-aged bride. But do the actresses who played the hot princesses saved from the Middle Ages get to play Bill and Ted's wives? No, they do not. They are replaced with younger models. So the original actress who played Joanna is now 52 and is replaced with Jemma Mace, who is 41. And then Erin Hayes, who plays the other one, is now 44. And I couldn't even find the age of Annette Askwee, who played the original one. Now, maybe they offered those roles to those two actresses who didn't want them. But I'm going to guess no. And that's fucking fucked up. How come women don't get to have their own middle-aged ennui? Like, this movie is not worthy of the Bill and Ted ethos.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. I think, and I thought about that watching these movies and about my own internalized sexism. I mean, I really did have an internal bogus journey of my own watching these and thinking about both of those things, the youth of the actresses who replaced them and the non-existence of those characters in both the first two movies. They're just, you know, girls that you win and then become sort of your pretty bride.
Mm-hmm. I'd love to jump in with just one comment about the Keanu performance, which is, you know, the funny thing about Keanu is that he's, and I say this advisedly, I know that Dana Stevens may clap back on this, but he is as close to a non-actor as you can get in a major movie star. I mean, his range is tiny. He's very wooden. He's gained control over his instrument by toning it down, 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 by never trying to stretch beyond what he's capable of in some way. And it's funny to see him as this kind of stiffened, melancholic, middle-aged, near lug in a way. I mean, he just, you know, the puppy is really gone in this subsequent performance, in this recent performance. And I found myself going back and forth between wondering, is he consciously making it this way, this stiffened, melancholic? Is it a comment on what it's like to grow older, or is he just older? And I actually thought that cognitive dissonance made watching it that much more affecting in a weird way.
But he's acting. I mean, I guess I can't, the small range observation I can't really refute, but you could say the same thing about Humphrey Bogart, right? I mean, there are so many movie stars that have that project themselves very powerfully, and their selves is the commodity that we want and that, you know, the movie casts them for.
Right.
I would say, I mean, we just talked about the third John Wick movie, right? In which Keanu is an action star and he moves in a completely different way. I talk about this in my review of the Bill and Ted 3 movie, that he's an incredibly physical actor. His comedy is physical, and you're right that, you know, the puppy-like physicality of the first Bill and Ted is a huge part of its charm, but he still does that puppy-like walk in this movie, but in a stiffened way. I mean, I actually have notes for my review about his walk and how much I love it, that he's got, you know, that bounce that the actress playing his daughter imitates so well. But of course, the bounce loses its bounce when you're in your 50s to some degree, but I don't think it's at all Keanu trying and failing to summon the old Ted.
No, Dana, that's totally fair. I mean, there's this kind of amazing rigor mortis that he's added to this character, and it's got a kind of existential heaviness to it.
Okay, well, can I tell you one thing I really liked about this movie?
Yes, please.
It delivered Dana Stevens' movie reviewing prose unto me on Slate.
Well, I had a great time reviewing it. I will say that it was a complete pleasure to just be able to dive into the universe, rewatch the first two movies, and just kind of, you know, have a think about what Bill and Ted has meant to me.
All right. It's Bill and Ted Face the Music. It's streaming. I watched it on Amazon Prime. I'm sure it's various outlets. But check it out. We'd love to hear what you think of Dana Stevens adoring Bill and Ted. So email us or hit us up on Twitter. Okay, moving on.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. Trust me, you've never seen a mother-son duo like this before. This show is full of wit, scandal, action, and did I mention Julianne Moore? Something this audacious and sexy is as genre-bending as it gets. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.
All right, before we go any further, this is where we usually talk business. Dana, what do we have?
Yes, Steve, all I have to say for business is that in Slate Plus today, in keeping with our all movie theme for this episode, we are going to talk about the future of theatrical movie screenings with Sam Adams, our frequent guest and Slate senior editor, who actually went to a movie this week. He got to see a small screening of Tenet, the new Christopher Nolan movie in Philadelphia. He's going to tell us about that experience, and we'll just talk and speculate a bit about what the future of theatrical screenings may be in our age of quarantine. To hear segments like that, of course, you can sign up for Slate Plus, Slate's membership program. And while we're talking about that, we wanted to extend our very sincere thanks to anyone who has signed up for Slate Plus recently. Because of you all, we are getting to go back to a weekly schedule, which we are thrilled about. And you also help to contribute to the health of the whole magazine at a time when the whole publishing industry has really been taking a big hit. All of that to say that memberships really do make a big difference for us, and if you hadn't signed up, we would not be able to be talking to you every week. If you have not yet signed up for Slate Plus, we can still really use your support. As we have spoken about before, when you become a member, you'll get ad-free podcasts, exclusive Plus-only content, like our conversation about the future of movie screenings this week, and lots of other benefits. It's only $35 for your first year, and you can sign up at slate.com/culture plus. So again, to all of you who have signed up, we really appreciate you.
Okay, for the next segment, we're joined by Wesley Morris, the Pulitzer Prize-winning critic at large for the New York Times. He's here to discuss the loss of Chadwick Boseman, the great actor, to colon cancer at the age of 43. Wesley, welcome back to the show.
Nice to be with you guys. I missed you.
We miss you all the time. It is great to have you back. So as you point out in your really beautiful elegy to Boseman, he was Jackie Robinson, James Brown, Thurgood Marshall, and of course Black Panther. And as you put it, had any actor spent more time in such enormous shoes in so brief a span? And you go on to make the very brilliant, very Wesley Morris point that he didn't look like the men he played, that that was somehow essential to what he was doing. Can you explain that?
When he played Jackie Robinson, that was the first of these of this stretch of his acting career, and he didn't really start acting in any, with any prominence until a little bit before that. I mean, playing Jackie Robinson in 2014, I believe, was his 2013-2014. That was his first major part in a movie, and it just was, you know, I will confess before I even finish this thought that, like, I think Jackie Robinson is one of the most handsome human beings ever born, period. And Chadwick Boseman is handsome in a different way. And I just thought, like, well, this just seems like strange casting. I mean, even watching the movie, you're just like, Chadwick Boseman is finding something in Jackie Robinson that has nothing to do with how he looks. And I think that one of the problems with the movie biography is that the people who make these things get so hung up on the verisimilitude and resemblance of circumstances and the people playing the people the movies that are about. Mm-hmm. And I just found that finding different ways to play these people that didn't, he had to do something to convince us he was these people because he knew he didn't look like any of them.
Right.
And seizing upon this, you know, the electricity of James Brown, the sort of the rectitude of Thurgood Marshall, and the just cocky certitude that is also extremely understated in Jackie Robinson. I mean, those are three different, very, very different people. And the through line for each of them for me was just a kind of pride in, I don't know. It was just a fascinating thing to observe in one actor in like 4 years of an actor's career.
Right. And then Marvel goes and spends hundreds of millions of dollars to make a tentpole movie kind of about Black dignity, right? And at this, then they put him at the center of it and he carries it. He carries it to $1 billion+ franchise. And you use that word dignity, but you say something quite interesting about it, which is that the problem with dignity, and I'm quoting you now, is that there's not much an actor can do with it, but he kind of did, right? I mean, he was just a tremendous actor, but also a tremendous movie star.
In the world of Black Panther, the thing that Chadwick Boseman, it's easy to overlook him because you've got Denai Guerrera and Lupita Nyong'o and Michael B. Jordan doing seemingly more and having more to do, but he is the center of all kinds of gravity in that movie. I mean, he has gravitas, and he is the moral center of the film and like the vision for whatever ideology exists in this movie. I mean, there's what Michael B. Jordan represents, obviously, and then there's what T'Challa represents, and the way that the sort of humor, which is easy to overlook, that Chadwick Boseman brings to that part. And it's not quite righteousness. He's playing royalty, and he plays a royal character with a understanding of how a certain kind of royalty would comport itself.
Wesley, one thing you mentioned in your tribute is you call him a kind of historian, which I think kind of comports with what you were saying earlier about his interpretation of those characters, you know, these huge legendary figures he played in biopics. But as I read about his life in these few days since he so unexpectedly died, I have been thinking of him as a more cerebral kind of figure than you might have thought from, you know, the guy who played Black Panther, right? I mean, those years that he wasn't yet making it in Hollywood, as you say, he was 35 when he played Jackie Robinson, right? But it's not as if he was sending in headshots in L.A. that whole time. Right, he was living in New York. Right. He was writing plays. He taught acting at the Schomburg Center in Harlem, I believe. That he was having this sort of life as a more indie, you know, alternative kind of actor, and not really looking for those kind of roles at all. And then going a little bit further back into his past, when he was at Howard University, he apparently worked at an African themed bookstore, right? Which then informed the way that he played T'Challa and the way that he kind of advised other actors on the set, like, let's try to use African accents, and, you know, we can't use European accents. He really had a sense of that character as a historical figure, right, in this alternate history, the history of the comic book superhero.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like it's funny because when a person dies, you attribute qualities to them as though they're unique and they're the only people who have them. But what lots of actors have what I'm about to say he had. But I really, really felt it with him because it's rare, which is that he didn't seem desperate ever, right? He didn't seem to ever, like, have an actorly moment. He only was ever serving the parts. And I think, you know, obviously playing James Brown, James Brown being this electric, you know, historically important figure who understood his blackness to function in a particular way, but also was incredibly contradictory as a human being. And there's something about the way Get On Up works where you don't feel that the actor playing the part there's anything vain in the actor playing the part. He has tapped into this narcissism and this sort of explosive performative quality in the person he's playing. And I would contrast that with, you know, with somebody like Rami Malek in Bohemian Rhapsody, or I feel like I'm watching an actor give a performance as a person who might be Freddie Mercury at some point.
Right.
And the actor keeps getting in the way of the person they're playing. You don't feel that with Chadwick Boseman. I mean, I don't know anything about, I didn't know anything about that man watching him play these parts, but I also didn't feel like he was using James Brown as a stepping stone for some other thing, i.e. winning an Oscar. And that kind of made the exploration of James Brown as a person more interesting to me.
There is something about his performances that I've been trying to articulate to myself that just feels like it's on this distinct plane. And I think that sense that they are so deeply centered in themselves. I mean, I guess it's a cliche to say that actors disappear into parts, and it's different even to disappear into parts where we have some sense of who the historical figure is, but there was something that seemed directed from his inner self rather than like mugging for the hypothetical audience, and yet also someone who was just really supremely conscious of the impact of the roles he chose and how he chose to portray them, and I don't think it's an accident that that his career was playing all of these legends and greats. I mean, he seemed drawn toward it.
even T'Challa, I mean, you know, I'm not, many, many people have written about like the political alignment of Black Panther with various, you know, political leaders and activist heroes. But I mean, it wasn't like, it's easy to just think of that part as a comic book part and as Black Panther and T'Challa as comic book figures, but there are real world corollaries for that part and for that man. And you know, just by extension, I mean, he, in addition to playing Thurgood Marshall, James Brown, and Jackie Robinson, he also is basically playing Martin Luther King or Barack Obama or, you know, something, someone along those lines who is a sort of universally respected figure, not even in the world of the comic books, but there's something about the power of that movie that turned Chadwick Boseman and that character into those things.
I think there's also a way in which, even though his performances seem very inner, he was aware of the import of his career.
You know,
a friend of mine pointed me to the speech that he gave when the Black Panther cast won the SAG Award for Best Ensemble.
Oh, yeah.
In which he quotes Nina Simone about being young, gifted, and Black.
To be young, gifted, and Black, we all know what it's like to be told that there is not a place for you to be featured, yet you are young, gifted, and Black. We know what it's like to be told to say there's not a screen for you to be featured on, a stage for you to be featured on. We know what it's like to be the tail and not the head. We know what it's like to be beneath and not above. And that is what we went to work with every day, because we knew
there's not an ounce of being self-conscious in the performances, but in the selection of the career, there is an incredible amount of care and craft about what his, how he's using his talent and what it's supposed to signal to whom. It's just so many of our big actors, even the ones whose talent we most admire, seem so buffeted about by Hollywood, even if they don't have to face the systemic racism of Hollywood, even if they're just like talented people who, you know, get a bad break and sign on with the director who turns out to, you know, to be able to author a career in the way that he did seems rare for any person in Hollywood, much less for a talented young Black actor in Hollywood. So there's something that just feels miraculous looking back at the span of it.
I wonder, like, the other two things I would like, there, I had two thoughts in thinking about like what his career and his death were like. So career wise, in terms of the way he approached his parts, I really think that, you know, his acting style is much closer to a person like Sidney Poitier than maybe anybody. I mean, you know, we don't give Sidney Poitier enough credit for like teaching an entire generation of people how to act in movies. I mean, Brando took up a lot of space with inventing a screen acting. But Poitier, while not entirely a method actor, was certainly, he had these expressionist qualities to him that were also deeply rooted in like, in rectitude. And I feel like that, like, so when he explodes in a movie, I mean, it really, something really must have gone wrong for him to lose it. And I feel like Chadwick Boseman had a little bit of that. And the other thing that came to mind for me, and I don't know if this happened for you guys, but I feel like this is the first celebrity death, and I could be wrong about this, at least in the movies, since Heath Ledger, where you just felt like something really important was lost very, very soon, or too soon.
Philip Seymour Hoffman maybe as
Well, Philip Seymour Hoffman is different, right? Like, because there just was so much more work than those two
good
people.
Good point. Yeah, well, it's true. So Wesley, I think, you know, you said it so beautifully right at the end of your piece. I think I'll just quote it. You said, "No one approximates this much greatness without a considerable reserve of greatness himself." And that just seems to sum it up.
Oh, yeah, it's true.
Wesley, I feel crass bringing in an industry question into this conversation about this man who in many ways was sort of outside and on the fringes of an industry, even as he was succeeding within it. But there was a huge online flap over the weekend about the question of whether Marvel would recast the role of T'Challa now that Chadwick Boseman is gone. And, you know, with obviously many people saying, you know, just leave it as it is. Don't retire that hero, essentially. But looking at the fact that Black Panther was one of the highest grossing movies, I believe, of all time, certainly of the Marvel Universe, it's really hard to imagine that they would just leave the prospect of future Black Panthers on the table. So I wonder how you personally feel about that and also just what you think industry-wise will happen.
I mean, can't they just make Daniel Kaluuya, like, take over? Black Panther is, anybody can play that. It's T'Challa that's the concern, right? Like, somebody else is going to be T'Challa. You know, Lupita Nyong'o could be Black Panther.
You guys, it's hiding in plain sight. He dies in the movie, and then Shuri becomes Black Panther.
Right, exactly. Right. I mean, yeah.
She takes on the mantle, then it's like a woman thing, too.
Yeah. I mean, I think that solution is very, very simple. They can spend the first hour of the movie honoring him in like a very elaborate sort of mourning ritual or something. And then, you know, the plot kicks in and exactly, Julia, Shuri is Black Panther.
All right. Well, we settled it here. I hope we all get our, you know, appropriate due on the story by credit. But
that's definitely how that
good
works.
Luck with that.
Yeah. My lawyer's on it right away. But Wesley, as always, it's just a complete pleasure to have you on the show on the way to your second Pulitzer Prize.
Oh, thank you, Stephen. It's nice to see you guys or talk to you guys. I could see you briefly, but now we're just talking.
Always a pleasure. All right, hang in there, man.
Talk to you guys later.
Bye, Wesley. Bye, Wesley.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on all your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Terrence Malick's 1978 film Days of Heaven unfolds with the simplicity of a fable or maybe even a biblical tale. It tells the story of a young couple, played by Richard Gere and Brooke Adams, who arrive as itinerant farm workers on a magnificent agricultural estate in the Texas Panhandle. To make their lives easier, they told people that they're brother and sister, they're lovers, and they have a young girl with them who's Gere's character's younger sister. This all takes place early on in the 20th century, just at the dawn of mechanization. There are automobiles and tractors, but they are a novel part of the landscape. The work that they have to do on this farm is pitilessly hard. And when the master of the house, played by Sam Shepard, falls for Brooke Adams, the Brooke Adams character, Gere's character hatches a scheme. I think you can probably guess what it is. What follows is a richly ambiguous love triangle. The movie was Malick's second after The Masterful Badlands. Let's listen to a clip.
And maybe to set up this clip, we should say that the voice you're going to hear is Linda Manz's voice. Her voiceover, as we'll talk about, provides most of the sound that you hear during the movie, along with the musical soundtrack. So this is her character, who's also named Linda, ruminating during the course of their trip from Chicago down to Texas.
I met this guy named Ding Dong. He told me the whole earth is going up in flames. Flames will come out of here and there, and they'll just rise up. The mountains are gonna go up in big flames. The water's gonna rise in flames. There's gonna be creatures running every which way. Some of them burnt, half their wings burning. People are gonna be screaming and hollering for help. See, the people that have been good, they're gonna go to heaven and escape all that fire.
Shocker! I need shocker!
But if you've been bad, God don't even hear you. He don't even hear you talking.
Well, Dana, you picked it. I'd love to hear why.
I mean, I knew that we were going weekly. I knew that our quarantine comfort movie series was going to come not to an end, but I think we're going to take it maybe once a month or something. And I wanted to pick, I don't know, I just wanted to go out with a bang and talk about a movie that has meant something to me really as long as I can remember. I can't remember when I first saw this movie, but that I've never gotten a chance to write or talk about anywhere professionally. This came out in 1978. It was Terrence Malick's second movie. His first was Badlands, which is widely regarded, I think, as one of the great sort of first movies, one of the great directing debuts of all time. But that was already 6 years before Badlands was. And after this movie, he would not make another movie for 20 years. His next movie after this was The Thin Red Line in 1998. So to me, growing up watching this movie, and again, I don't remember when I first saw it, but it would have been somewhere in my adolescence, like just as I was becoming a cinephile, basically. I'm sure it was on the big screen because that would have been the only place to see it probably in those days. And Terrence Malick at the time was shrouded in this kind of mystery, this guy who had made two incredible movies and then essentially become a recluse, and it was not known whether he would ever make one again. Then after Thin Red Line in 1998, he started to become somewhat prolific by his standards and has made a bunch of movies in recent years, which that's going down another whole path. I mean, we've talked about Tree of Life on this show, which has its defenders and its detractors and is a strange, more of a shaggy mess, but I think a beautiful shaggy mess. This movie is the opposite of a shaggy mess, even though the history of its making which is extremely interesting to read about, was a huge, big, shaggy process that Steve could easily have become a Heaven's Gate kind of situation. Malick went way over time. He went way over budget. You know, various members of the crew had to leave because he was taking so long to finish. It was actually shot almost completely by the legendary cinematographer Nestor Almendros, who had worked with Romer and Truffaut and European directors before this. It was his first Hollywood movie. But he had to leave before it was over. And then Haskell Wexler, another legendary cinematographer, came in and finished the movie. There were all kinds of stories like that behind the scenes. You know, the producers being furious that Malick was taking so long. He was keeping helicopters waiting, you know, while he tried to get a perfect shot of a locust on a stalk of grain or something. And in that process, which extended to the post-production period where, you know, he edited it for years and it was like it was never going to come out. And he actually decided to scrap huge amounts of the dialogue that had been recorded and bring in that Linda Mann's voiceover that we heard in the clip to be almost the entire, you know, machine that narrates the movie. But given all of that, it somehow coheres into this perfect gem-like thing, right? I mean, there's not a single frame of this film that I would change. There's not any performance or image that doesn't seem to just somehow be magically right. And to me, knowing some of that history behind it makes that even more amazing, because Malick has this very lyrical, contemplative filmmaking style that seems like it would be a disaster on screen, and that has at times been a disaster on screen in subsequent years, but that just achieved that kind of gem-like perfection this one time.
Julia, had you seen it before?
No, I never saw it. And I loved it. If you're going to make a lyrical, nearly dialogueless film, make it 90 minutes and make it great. That's my takeaway from this movie. Like the combination of feeling open, curious, expansive in a kind of American pioneer-y way, and feeling unorthodox in its storytelling, with being an incredibly compact and considered story that actually has a lot of kind of action and plot in it, is so striking and really satisfying. Also, just the faces in it are incredible. I don't know. I haven't tracked Brooke Adams's career particularly, but the set of her mouth, she has this amazing, like, lush frown is the set of her face, and sort of watching her act, you know, the Linda Mann's performance is also extraordinary, and the movie's also just heartbreaking, like the conclusion of it, which I don't think we should spoil here, even though it's a 40-odd-year-old movie. I was blown away. This is a great film that I'm so glad to have watched.
Yeah, it's my second time around. I saw it in the movie. I saw it in the theater on a revival in the 90s, I think. And I liked it then. I loved it this time. Something about it really, really got to me this time. I think I went in with too much hype. I think Malick hadn't made the third film yet. So there was this Salinger-esque shroud of, you know, mystery around him as the Hollywood exile. And it has a reputation of being the most beautiful cinematographically, you know, beautiful movie maybe an American director has ever made. I think it lives up to that. It is that beautiful. I found its beauty overburdened the film the first time I saw it, but this time I understood it so much better. That exactly as Julia says, there's this story of compactness, of elemental simplicity at the center of it that does have the force of a fable. But for all of that simplicity, it actually is quite richly ambiguous as well, because neither man really knows if he's in a love triangle. Like, once you get into the plot of the movie, and she's, I don't think it gives anything away to say, she's entrapped within what is supposed to be a sham marriage. You know, just as Sam Shepard is beginning to suspect it might be a sham marriage, Richard Gere is beginning to suspect it might have turned into a real one, and he may have outthought himself as a would-be con man and is going to lose the love of his life to this rich person. And at that moment, all of the significance of the movie rests, as you say, Julia, on this remarkable face, you know, and remarkable performance by a great actress. It's not just that she looks extraordinary, but it's, you know, it's really a great performance by Brooke Adams. And it's true, the lush frown is, what a wonderful phrase. You know, Florence Pugh often performs with a lush frown as well. It's
That's a good echo, yeah.
Nice comp, right? I mean, it just doesn't, it's not a very common thing to see in movies, and they both pull it off really beautifully. The one thing I will say is that for an itinerant farm worker, Gear has a closet full of really beautiful crepe outerwear and a really great haircut.
Yeah, I mean, I love also what this movie is doing just with the idea of the West, like the scene when Gear finally gets inside the house. So the whole movie, which was actually shot in Alberta, but is supposed to be the Texas Panhandle. We're just outside for almost all of it. There's sort of one or two interiors before. In the middle of the film, the Sam Shepard character takes away his new bride and says, "Oh, why don't you hang out in the big house," which is this very upright, vertical, in contrast to all of the horizontals of the horizon in the film. Little box on this plane, and Gear walks inside, and it's as though furnishings are from Mars. Like, just the idea of a couch is so alien. And, you know, watching it from, you know, my couch that I dialed up from CB2 or whatever, just thinking about the kind of roughness of the landscape, I just loved that scene when Malick's camera, which had been so often turned on herons and wind-tossed wheat and rippling troughs and steely-eyed bison, is just like, check out that decanter. Whoa.
I want that house and everything in it. I think it's worth mentioning that house, which is so, it has this remarkable shape, right? It looks like something out of a painting. It's a very painterly movie in general, but that...
It looks like Christina's World.
Yeah, like a Wyeth painting, which I'm sure was one of the visual influences. But that house was built entirely for the movie. When I was watching, I was thinking, where did they find such a, in perfect condition, right? This old wood-framed house. And in fact, that house was built from top to toe by Jack Fisk, the production designer, who's another kind of legendary figure in movies and has collaborated with Malick throughout his career. So again, there's that deliberateness, right? I mean, the decanter and the velvet couch were very carefully chosen and or built to create exactly that feeling in that moment.
Another thing I love about this movie is that, you know, it's the late 1970s where movie directors were given blank checks in order to write socially introspective, you know, in order to make socially introspective movies about America. It just, it's such an anachronism, really, to think about it. And this movie's politics are, I think, Julia, as you say, they're sort of about this contrast between the people out in the field doing the work and this, you know, indoor space of bourgeois refinery, and who gets to be inside, who never gets to come inside. But there are all these shots that are, you know, the shots of nature are like a Wyeth painting, or the house and, you know, wheat fields are like a Wyeth painting, but the shots of the faces are like Walker Percy almost, right? It's sort of these, the movie seems to be saying, these are our ancestors, right? These are the circumstances out of which many of our American ancestors arose.
Yeah, Steve, that's very true. And you see it in the credit sequence very clearly, that idea of the film being this kind of fictional genealogy of America. Because the opening credits with the beautiful, beautiful Ennio Morricone theme that as soon as you hear this movie, you will forever associate with it, show these images that may actually be old photographs by Jacob Riis or something like that. Photographs of, you know, people in the inner city and children in tenements around the turn of the century. I'm not sure whether some of those are original and or some of them were, you know, created to look old. But the very last one you see, the last image, is not just a generic face that seems historic, but Linda Manns, the girl who will wind up being our narrator and in a way the movie's protagonist, right? And so there's this moment when history kind of converges on this one person who will be the voice that guides us. And I love the way that the credit sequence in this movie becomes part of the story.
I mean, one thing I love about the movie is that it does not feel like it's moralizing. Like the story of, you know, migrant couple seeking security in America pulls a con on a sick rich farmer and gets their comeuppance could feel pedantic, but it really doesn't, I think, because of Gere's performance, because of Shepherd's performance, because of Adams's performance. Like the encounters there seem much more complicated and less simplistic than that. And then I think I don't feel that the film or that Malick is judging Brooke Adams for enjoying life as the lady of the house and
not at all.
Wearing nice things and returning to her dreams of being a dancer and learning some dance steps on the porch. You know, like the movie does not condemn her. She's not seen as less for enjoying her escape from incredibly difficult toil. But it is capacious enough to allow for both. I mean, and this is a bit spoilery, but in the final scenes of the film, I'll try to say this without spoiling too much, but she believes that a certain kind of domesticity that leaves room for art and dance is the happiest possible resting place to find. But the Linda Manns character disagrees and thinks the kind of adventure and uncertainty and exploration is what home is for her as an American girl. And I just love that the movie seems so non-judgmental about those twin threads.
Yeah, I mean, to pull out the perspective even further, it's one of those films that manages to be about this particular story, the love triangle, the con, you know, what's going to happen with these four people who are almost the only people that we really get to know or see speak in the movie. But because, as you say, Julia, it's the camera is always turning away to contemplate rippling wheat or, you know, huge skies over fake Texas, actually Alberta, Canada, and to look at the nature surrounding them in this on this vast scale, it feels, as Steve said, as if it's about history as well. And it achieves all of that with so little. I think that something that was discussed in the pre-production conversations with the cinematographer and other crew members was that this should be filmed like a silent film, which for Malick meant in part that it would use almost all natural light, which it does to an extraordinary degree. Another part of the reason it went so far over budget is that they always wanted to shoot during magic hour, right? During this little period, the cinematographer said it was 20 minutes a day or so, you know, that the light was just golden, but, you know, not dark yet. The only other thing I would mention, and it's only because she passed so recently, is that Linda Manns in this movie is just a complete revelation, and it would not have been remotely the same movie without her. I mean, even to the degree that I think she made up and riffed a lot of the things that she's saying. That crazy clip we heard about a guy named Ding Dong who told her that, you know, heaven and hell would be bursting into flames. That whole thing was essentially stream of consciousness that she said into a microphone in post-production when Terrence Malick brought her in and said, you know, do your Linda Manns thing. And there are some beautiful pieces written about her since her death where you can learn a little bit about her. But she was a very unusual outlier figure who, you know, did not at all fit into the Hollywood mode or audition for this in any sort of normal way. She was really sort of a find of Terrence Malick's, and the two of them really created that voiceover together. It's quite extraordinary.
All right. Well, the movie is Days of Heaven. We all really enjoyed watching or rewatching it. Check it out. It's streaming various places. Let us know what you thought. All right, moving on. All right, now's the moment in the podcast when we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Steven, in keeping with our all movie theme, I want to endorse something that has to do with one of the movies that we talked about. So Alex Winter, the co-star with Keanu Reeves of the Bill and Ted trilogy, has spent most of the intervening years since the first Bill and Ted movies being a director rather than an actor. He's acted some, but mainly he's directed a lot of TV, some documentaries. He's stayed on that side of the camera. And he just happens to have a new documentary that came out just recently, pretty shortly before the Bill and Ted 3 movie, that has to do with his own career in a way, and even Keanu's. It's called Showbiz Kids, and it's about the history of child performers on film, in which he sits down, he himself a former child performer. Actually, I thought of this, Steve, when you said during our Bill and Ted segment that they were both green when the first movie came out, which, especially for Alex Winter, was not true at all. They had both been child actors. I mean, Keanu more like a teen actor. You know, I think he'd been acting since maybe 14, 16 years old. But Alex Winter had been acting since he was 8. So he got interested as a filmmaker in this question of what it is to be a Hollywood child actor and what your future is like, and interviews a whole bunch of well-known former juvenile stars, including Diana Sari Carey, who was Baby Peggy of silent film fame and who just died, I believe, earlier this year. But he got some of the last interviews with her. She's a huge personality and really fun to listen to. But so are many other stories in this documentary. So it's on HBO. It's called Showbiz Kids, directed by Alex Winter. And it's really, really worth watching.
Oh, cool. Julia, what do you have?
I also have a film to round out our very film-centric show. It is worth watching the romantic comedy Plus One, which came out in a proper theatrical release in 2019, a pretty teeny tiny indie that premiered at Tribeca last year. It stars Maya Erskine, who's one of the stars of Pen 15, and Jack Quaid, who is the son of Meg Ryan and Dennis Quaid, as lovelorn people in the wedding season of their lives who agree to be each other's plus ones for a year of wedding going. You will never guess what happens to them. But Maya Erskine's performance in particular is just completely stunning. And the movie is, like, solid. Like, I'm not going to tell you it's the best romantic comedy you've ever seen or that it does anything particularly wild with the form. But it's just a good time. And the thing I loved most about it is that a recurring gambit in the film, which takes place mostly at weddings, is that each new wedding is opened with a toast. And the way the toasts are written is just so... I know, Dana, you spoiled Palm Springs, and I saw it too. Like, there are toasts in movies, and Palm Springs is a movie where you return to a toast in the movie several times because of the plot of the movie. That feel like they're sort of about the couple, but they're enforcing the themes of the movie. Like, they feel like pieces of screenwriting. The toasts and the performances of the toasts in this film really feel like awkward documentaries excised from actual weddings you've been to, and they're great.
Mm. All right. This week I'm going to just endorse, I hate to bring down the room, but I just want to endorse two, I think, sadly opposite essays on fascism. The first is, they're both in the New York Review of Books. One is recent. It's by Sarah Churchwell, who's an American lit professor in London. It's called American Fascism, It Has Happened Here. And it's just a salutary reminder that, in fact, we have a long history of flirting with far-right politics in this country in ways that are very dark, very violent, and that the idea that Trump is somehow sui generis or came out of nowhere as a total surprise or somehow doesn't have roots in something essentially American is just completely ahistorical and false. And she argues that, I think, quite elegantly. And the second, which I may have mentioned on the show before, is a 1995 essay by Umberto Eco, famous, of course, for the novel The Name of the Rose. But he wrote an essay called Ur-Fascism, UR-Fascism, which is just... it is just the perfect essay. It's autobiographical. It's historically informed. It, you know, essentially what it does is just lay out what the essence of fascistic thinking and would-be governance are. And there's a 14-point list, and it just is, unfortunately, it's just a timely essay now. And I hate to have to recommend it, but I do. All right, well, we'll have links to all of that on our show page. Dana, thank you so much.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Julia.
Thank you.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page. That's slate.com/culturefest. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com. We love it when you do. You can hit us up on Twitter. It's @SlateCultFest. Our producer is Cameron Drews. Our production assistant is Rachel Allen. For Dana Stevens and Julia Turner, I'm Stephen Metcalf. Thank you so much for joining us. We will see you soon.
The new Starz series, Mary and George, starring Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, tells a story almost too outrageous to be true, but shockingly, it is. With next to nothing to her name and looking to elevate her social standing, Mary Villiers sets her handsome and charming son George on the path to seduce King James I and become his all-powerful lover. The show is full of wit, scandal, action. You won't be able to look away. Watch the season premiere of Mary and George now, only on Starz and the Starz app.